This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. When immigrants come to this country, they face a lot of challenges. One of them is access to proper mental health treatment. A group of mental health professionals got together in 2001 to coordinate services for the immigrant population. The need has only increased since then, and by 2005, that organization adopted the name El Futuro. El Futuro is hosting a conference Friday at the UNC Chapel Hill School of Social Work on Latino behavioral health. Joining us now to talk about it are Carla Siu, she is clinical manager for El Futuro, and Luke Smith, executive director. Welcome to both of you. Good to have you here.
Thank you.
So, Carla, tell us about the need, the scope of the problem in the Latino community for mental health assistance.
I would say that the need in the Latino community is very similar to the needs of mental health issues in other populations. However, I think the access issue, because of the language, becomes greater, which is why we are doing the work that we're doing, is we want to provide the same services, the same quality of services to the Latino community. And so some of it are anxiety, depression issues, issues of migration trauma is what we see a lot at our clinics. And so we, I think, have a lot of the same issues with some complications from the fact that they are first-generation immigrants is a lot of the people that we see. And so with that come a lot of other challenges.
Well, Luke, I want to get a sense of how things have changed over time. The group got together, mental health professionals, in 2001, recognizing something is going on. How much has changed since then?
Yeah, well, I think it's obvious how much has changed. Just driving around town here, you can see the different restaurants, and I'm happy about that because I really like the food. When I came to North Carolina, it was for a residency program in psychiatry, and as I was walking around the hospital, I spoke a little bit of Spanish, and that got me into trouble because I was dragged into rooms and asked to translate and do some brief counseling here and there. And so I got to know people, and a little bit of Spanish became a lot more. And I think what I really started realizing was that it wasn't just about a sign on a door or a language that I spoke, but also the culture. And so I think that's probably the change on one end for us, as we've seen this new culture come in, heard the language, tasted the food. But then it's also been a change for them as they've come in to experience our culture. And that's a real interesting dynamic for us. As me as a psychiatrist in training, I just was fascinated by it. And I grew to like it more and more, really practiced my Spanish with note cards and everything else I could. But it was an immersion experience, truly, better than I probably could have had somewhere else.
Well, clearly language is one challenge, but Carla, I would guess that cultural differences play a large part in this too. Expectations on the part of the professionals and on the part of the patients that may not match at all. But so give us an idea of what some of these clashes might look like.
I think one of the things is in Latin America, we don't think of going to a psychiatrist or a psychologist as a first line. I think that there are strong family systems that people go to as a first resort for help. And so coming to a new country and then having this new way of accessing help is foreign to begin with. And so that would be one cultural consideration when we're trying to engage this population, is try to say, these are the services that are being provided, and this is actually what counseling is, and this is how it might be beneficial to you.
So you start there, and of course, for you, Luke, I mean, this is not foreign. This is how we do mental health service in this country. Did that take you a while to understand? And I would still think, perhaps, a challenge for you to be sitting across from someone who isn't quite sure that this whole process is the way it should be going.
Mm. Yes. I mean, I'm a child psychiatrist, and to think about introducing something like a medication to a person who really, if they're thinking medicine, they may be thinking about an herbal medicine or a remedy of that sort, or have gone to a pharmacy where they didn't need a prescription. So this is a very different system that we have set up here. To come into that and to introduce even the idea of maybe it's a mental illness that's explaining this behavior. It's not just a discipline problem. There's a lot of explanation that we have to do, and then to try to do it sensitively and give it time where people can incubate it a little bit and move it forward in their own minds, come back and struggle with it. Mm. And I think that's what we do a lot, is we struggle with the people as they're struggling with the illness, as they're struggling with the new culture, with the changes all around them, we find ourselves oftentimes being advocates for people in the classroom, talking with teachers and administrators, going into environments that psychiatrists and therapists wouldn't normally go into, and moving really outside of our room, our office, where we see them. So we have to take it to the street in some sense.
And Carla, I understand that lines of authority is another issue. Again, we have this doctor-patient relationship. We get the way it works in this country. To a certain extent, the doctor's an authority. We get to ask questions, but, you know, you're the boss. It's not always that way in countries in Latin America.
It is and it isn't. And sometimes it's interesting because one of the experiences I've had is initially when I first started this work, they would want to call me doctor, and I'm not a doctor. And so there was that dynamic where there were times, many times I said, I am not a doctor. And they would say back to me, doctor so-and-so. And so I think there was a need almost or a desire for hierarchy. And I think in school I was taught not to have that hierarchy. So that was actually one of those first on-the-field experiences where I just kind of finally said, okay, if you want to call me doctor, that's fine. And if that's what you need, I'm going to be okay with that. And there's also the relational piece where that is where a lot of the engagement that I have with clients comes in, where there's that sense of need for hierarchy. But on the other hand, there's also a need for connection and relationship. And that takes a long time, as Luke said, to incubate. You just have to spend that time before you can actually win their trust.
How much of those, the fact of those broken connections, those social networks, how big a part does that play in the mental illnesses that you see and have to treat?
I think that's a huge element in the work that we do. As we were thinking about the work for the conference and the presentations, a lot of the work we're doing is attachment-based. And so we are – significant amount of our treatment is spent on loss and separation and reconnection of family.
Does that change the way you understand treatment and therapy, Luke? I mean, can you just sort of put that into some category of post-traumatic stress or loss or grief and say, I'll treat it like that? Or is there a particular set of circumstances that are part of the immigrant experience that need to be seen a new way?
Yeah, the loss and the stress amplifies a lot of what we see. So if you have somebody with depression or with an anxiety disorder or insomnia, it just becomes that much worse. And in general, this population, the new immigrant population, has lower rates of mental illness and substance abuse than the general population in North Carolina. That's what we found. Now, the longer they stay here, it seems to approximate the rates that we see here, which is a head scratcher, I guess. Mm-hmm. But for now, whenever we see people, they're oftentimes in a lot of distress from some of these stresses that Carla's been talking about. And that just makes it that much worse. And so we do look around and try to collaborate with people on how can we bring down some of those stresses. But we then need to remember our specialty, which is to help that person who's suffering from a real depression or a real schizophrenia or bipolar disorder, whatever it might be.
Well, I wonder, especially when it comes to some of the more profound disorders like the ones that you just mentioned, whether those folks just don't make it here. I mean, to some extent, the people who make it here are in better shape when they get here. Mm. And then there is, you know, whatever it is about this society. And of course, their children then are born into the population and become part of the normal statistics, right?
Mm-hmm. That's right. Yeah, it's interesting how the border almost acts as a sieve or a screen for people who aren't as organized with their thoughts. So it's harder to make it this far north. And colleagues in Texas will tell me that they have higher rates of people who do have those more persistent and severe chronic mental illnesses. And that's where they kind of are stopped because they don't have the organizing ability to get this far north. Although the longer people stay, the more they approximate our population in terms of the rates of mental illness. But another interesting phenomenon is the young nature of this group, that it's a childbearing population or age. And the young men, for instance, may be working in factories at nighttime and missing a lot of sleep. And it's a stressful time, and that's a time of a psychotic illness could emerge. And so just like it may emerge on a college campus where you're missing a lot of sleep and around a lot of new stresses and away from family, it's kind of a similar effect going on.
So, Carla, are you advocating a kind of a separate treatment channel along the lines of El Futuro? You develop a separate clinic-based network, or are you trying to get the word out to practitioners, you know, in other fields so that Latino immigrants or any immigrant could go anywhere and receive kind of culturally appropriate treatment?
I think ideally this is work that would be shared with the community. And so I think with the conference, we're trying to really have everybody understand some of the same issues that we are facing because we're learning them right now. Part of what we're doing is coming together with other experts who have experienced some of this because it touches all of our institutions in our community. We collaborate with the ER, we collaborate with a lot of other medical providers. And so ideally, we all grow to learn how to engage this population.
Are the challenges different or perhaps more difficult in one part of the state over another? Are rural areas more difficult or less than urban areas?
I would say similarly to other services, being in a rural area adds some transportation issues. So that's very similar. I think that would be every rural area has access struggles. And we do have a clinic in Chatham County, and that's our clinic where we do most of our rural work. And we do feel challenged there to get people to the clinic or appointments, and the type of work that people do out there is different. And so the hours, we have to accommodate our hours to meet that population's needs.
Luke, I wonder if you found any subtle differences. We do this thing, of course. We talk about Latino immigrants, Asian Americans, all coming from different countries. They're coming from different regions within those countries. All of them have their different various stresses and cultural imperatives. And I wonder if you've begun to see subtle distinctions among the various populations of people who all fall under that one umbrella.
Mm-hmm. That's a good question. I'm challenged to really think of it and not bring it into a more hard stereotype because I, at the same time, feel like everybody who comes into the office is a distinct individual person. And so while I think sometimes there's some generalizations with things that really excite me sometimes, I like to think about, oh, wow, they're from a rural village versus from the big city of Mexico. The challenge more for me is that's more of a fascination. I think the challenge more is just to remember the underpinnings of the humanity of this person and really to honor that. The thing that we do in our clinic is try to make it – we have a low-cost service in our three clinics and the work we do. We bring people in, but we don't want them to feel that it's low cost. We want to honor them as people, and we want to really support that and support the family to reunify or whatever it might be. And so as they come in, it's to really look at that individual person and to know that, yes, they speak Spanish, they have a culture they bring in, but at the end of the day, this is just a really hurting person, really.
Well, has the research gone far enough? Is the practice of medicine and psychiatric medicine developed enough to be able to do those things, to find the essential qualities of humanness, but also understand the distinctions of cultural difference and regional difference, and how that might bear on this individual person I'm looking at?
Yeah, it's a really amazing thing that happened when we started El Futuro. Back in the day, we got together. We had a lot of energy. A lot of us did speak Spanish, growing amounts of Spanish, not as much as Carla over here, who's very fluent. But we went out and we looked around at states like Texas and Florida and Chicago and California, and we looked for interventions there that may work in the community here. What was really amazing was that this is a first-generation community, not like the long-term entrenched generational communities in those places. So some of the practices there you can't just cookie cutter and bring them over and make them work here. So it's been a real adventure to try to take those and adapt them, take some of ours and adapt them. And we continue to adapt and try to understand what's going to work. And we have to remain open and good learners, I think, of not just the culture, but also the effect of our work.
Well, what have you learned, Carla?
I think some of the things I've learned in practice are the way that I approach the family, for instance. There's a focus, for instance, on the individual a lot. When I was in school, we would try to isolate what this individual was going through. And what I learned very quickly was I really wasn't going to help that individual until I engaged the family system. And so how I started engaging those parents who are often sometimes viewed as the problem, if you're saying, well, if mom and dad did blank, you know, and then just kind of elevate them to a position of respect and say, let me engage you in this way. And with the same end of helping the entire system work through some of the conflicts that they're experiencing, have a lot more success with that approach than I do going straight for working solely with an adolescent, for instance.
With that individual. Although, Luke, it seems to me, if I've got this right, that that is part of the training here, too, is that this is not just the problem of the individual. It's the problem of the family, even for American families. And so yet it sounds like you can do that kind of therapy, the individual intervention here, better than you can with Latino families where perhaps this idea of family network is more robust. I mean, is that what you're finding, is that this stuff should work for everybody, but it turns out it works, what I was taught works better for this immigrant population?
Yeah, it's amazing the natural strengths there that we can draw on, really go to something that's sometimes a cultural tradition. Whereas I look around sometimes and wonder, what are the traditions that are so cultural that we need to preserve? They're very iconic in that culture. And then you watch that quinceañera just bring people together, or the all the activities around church and family and the traditions at different holidays. They become very, very good places for people to rally and to remember identity and to reconnect. It's an amazing thing to watch and to be a part of. I love being invited to some of those.
Carla, tell us about the conference and what you hope to accomplish.
Well, the conference is happening on February 1st, so this Friday we'll have one of the adaptations that we're talking about. The dialectical behavioral therapy is it's a mouthful, but it's DBT. It's done widely across the U.S., but we have piloted a group that we titled Mente Sana, and so we have experts from Duke, Colleen Sloan, who's worked with Marsha Linehan, who developed this model, will be talking a little bit about the rationale behind DBT, and then we're going to talk about our pilot and how we are adapting that to meet the needs of the Latino community.
Well, tell me, did you just describe that earlier, the treatment that you're talking about? What is it?
Dialectical behavioral therapy. It is a mode of therapy that is being used primarily to treat borderline personality disorder, and that it's more experiential and kind of incorporates mindfulness, and being in the present is the focus of this modality. And just we found it's been very effective to treat trauma, to treat a lot of different depression, anxiety, and so we've adapted it to meet the Latino community's needs.
And of course, interestingly enough, those kinds of treatments and those ideas are becoming more and more widely used in the population at large as well, as part of treatment and therapy. Mm-hmm. So what are the costs? What if we don't pay attention to this and just sort of let it go and say, look, particularly for that portion of the immigrant population that may not be here legally, why are you accessing services at all? These are our services, and you don't deserve them. You're not here legally. What's the cost of taking that point of view?
Well, the cost that I can see is that I won't get communications like I've received this morning from several teachers who say, this child is doing so much better in class and is learning now and is able to attend and focus and is able to not worry about what's going on. And wow, the mother was in here helping out today at school. That's an amazing difference to watch activated parents and children who are ready to learn. And people who can show up to their jobs and not feel sleep deprived and feel attentive when they're there. And a lot of little things, but they're also big things. And I think it's refreshing for us to be around that and to see those direct impacts.
Thank you both for being on the program.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Luke Smith is executive director of El Futuro. Carla Siu is a clinical manager for El Futuro and the Latino Behavioral Health Conference. Will be held Friday at the UNC School of Social Work. For more information, go to elfuturo-nc.org. Coming up next, we'll go to a place where science and art meet. Stay tuned.